Good morning, you're on Rally Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've got one of our favourite guests and a very special friend of mine and a champion New Zealand, Dr. Don Brash. Good morning.
Good morning, Rodney. Good to see you.
Look, most people your age would be in a nursing home. And here you are. You've had this glittering career, Reserve Bank Governor, Leader of the National Party, Leader of the ACT Party, MP. Amazing. And you're doing this fantastic job heading up Hobson's pledge for one law for all New Zealand. And when you started out, the media were able to paint you, or attempted to paint you, into a corner, and to, of your scene with Don Brash, you're a sort of racist or nutty. And it's amazing to me, looking from the outside, Don, that it's now a mainstream issue and front and centre of today's politics. You've done an extraordinary job.
Well, I'm not sure that I have done an extraordinary job, but the issue has become very important for many New Zealanders. When we started in 2016, we were a very small organization. We had almost no money in the bank, but we were very determined. Initially, of course, we were called Hobson's Choice. Some people still use that name, but we discovered that Hobson's Choice, and we called it that because Governor Hobson had chosen a one law for all model, because that seemed the right name. But we've discovered that Hobson's Choice was the brand name of a bacon company. So we had to abandon that name and change to Hobson's Pledge. Governor Hobson pledged that we'd all be one people when he signed the treaty on behalf of the Crown, as Maori chiefs signed on their own behalf. So, no, we've grown very substantially since that time. We currently have something like 140,000 people who get our regular emails.
Wow.
That doesn't mean they've all paid a sub, of course.
No.
It means they've expressed an interest. And we go through that list and prune it from time to time. When people don't bother opening the emails, we think they're no longer interested. So we think we've got roughly 140,000 people who are strongly interested in the issue.
Well, politicians can't ignore that.
Well, no, they can't. But I'm bound to say that we are quite disappointed with the progress which has been made, or rather not made. I mean, I think many people felt deeply concerned with the Ardern government. They were hell-bent on creating a very different kind of society, I guess encapsulated by the so-called Hei Puapua report, which envisages that by 2040, the bicentenary of the Treaty of Waitangi, New Zealand will already be a co-governed country, with Maori, people of Maori descent having sort of co-equal rights with people of other ethnicities. Now, we were very much appalled by that and some of the things that they were doing around that. I guess one of the best examples of it being Three Waters, which envisaged the whole water infrastructure of the country being governed by teams of people, half of whom would be of Maori extraction and half would be of not Maori extraction. And we thought that was appalling. Government changed, and we were enthusiastic about that because, on the face of it, all three parties seemed to be committed to a situation where every New Zealander would be treated equally, regardless of their ancestry. There were some very specific agreements in the coalition, agreements between National and ACT, between National and New Zealand First, which we were very enthusiastic about. And some of those have been attempted, but others have not even really made much progress at all. And I think, for example, of the commitment in the National New Zealand First coalition agreement that all legislation which includes reference to the principles of the treaty would be amended to delete that expression. That hasn't even been started, to the best of my knowledge. And of course, we've seen the Treaty Principles Bill, which was again part of the new National ACT coalition agreement, introduced into Parliament, but with the Prime Minister making it very clear indeed that he will not be supporting it beyond the sort of committee stage. So, yes, there's been some progress, at least on paper, but in many respects is disappointing.
Just on that, when Mr. Luxon said that he would put it to a select committee but not support it beyond, I think that was a big hit that he took, because he could have said, we're not keen on it. John Key was like that with three strikes. We're not keen on it, but let's see what people say.
Yeah.
And then decide no, or then decide yes, whatever, or change it. But to rule it out before New Zealanders had a say seemed to me to show them up.
Well, in some ways, worse even than that. I mean, what he said in at one point, I think in a post-cabinet press conference, was asked whether there was nothing at all in the bill that he liked. He said, no, there was nothing in it at all. Well, when you look at the three main clauses of that bill, it's very hard indeed to see how any National Party leader can say there's nothing in it. I mean, the first one, article, the first principle is the government has got the right to govern. Well, there'll be a few radicals who don't agree with that proposition, but you'd have thought the National Party leader would have been strongly in favour of such a proposition. But
Particularly if you're the Prime Minister.
absolutely.
Tell me,
Absolutely.
do you think they're absolutely oblivious to the problem?
I don't know. I don't know.
Because you sort of feel as though they're oblivious to the fundamental problem bubbling away and what it means for civil society. And they're sort of seeing it as a political skirmish to sort of manage their way through, rather than to say, hang on, this is what we fought and died for, Māori and Pākehā alike. Seriously, we fought and died for that. I find it very hard to get on into their thinking. And of course, we don't have now any opportunity to see a prime minister interviewed about these things at any depth, and to the extent they do a longer interview, the interviewer is already on side on these matters. Tell me, Don, explain for me co-governance, because it's a term that gets bandied around, and I don't understand it. What is co-governance?
Well, I think in general terms, it means that somehow people who have some Maori ancestry, always now, of course, with other ancestry as well, should have, in some sense, equal political status with the rest of the population, regardless of the numbers involved. And that's the sort of broad definition of it. And we see it implemented in a whole variety of different ways. But it means basically giving Maori culture a status which is on a par with all other status, all other cultures in the country. And we see it again and again in public institutions. I mean, you may well be aware of the involvement that Janet Dixon had with the Real Estate
Yes.
Authority. The Real Estate Authority thought it was quite appropriate to make a course in Maori culture mandatory for all real estate agents. And when Janet Dixon objected to that, they said, well, we have the right now to cancel your license and you cannot reapply for it for 5 years. And we thought that was absolutely outrageous. But in a whole range of institutions, this kind of equality between Maori culture and other culture is reasserting itself. You may be aware that Internet NZ, which controls the internet, what's the word I'm looking for?
The
The
World Wide Web.
yeah, that's right. Is mandating that there will be two chairmen of Internet New Zealand, one must be Maori. This is bizarre. And you see it in pharmacy, you see it in a whole range of issues throughout the country. And it's
It's
like,
a good idea not to live in Wellington. Because
that's
this
right.
stuff all seems to just bubble around in that little precinct, right?
Well, it's
Well,
Wellington.
there's two, you've hit upon two things really. Because we have to bow down to Maori culture, like if you're a real estate agent. And funnily enough, if you did the treaty course and relied on Sir Hugh Carfrae's translation, you wouldn't pass that course, right? Because you've got to have the modern 1980s activists' translation of the treaty to pass. But on the one hand, you're seeing in the midwifery and real estate and pharmacy, you're seeing this not as a co-governance thing, but the idea that because Maori was an indigenous culture, it takes precedence over everything, and you have to defer to it. When we went along to our local school to be welcomed, my wife had to sit at the back along with the other woman. Right?
Yeah.
So you have to defer to it. And of course, it has a untouchable status because you don't dare criticize Maori culture or Maori, but you can trash Western culture day in and day out and Europeans for being racist just
Yep.
by living.
Yep.
So there's that, which I actually see as something different to co-governance. Because then you have on top of that, every political organization, and ultimately it'll be our corporations and our private companies. We've seen this in other jurisdictions like Malaysia, for example, which you're familiar with, where companies have had to be 50% Malay and 50% Chinese to incorporate. But what we're seeing here so far is in our public institutions where councils, health boards, school boards are having to adopt or are choosing to adopt a co-governance model where some proportion, with the aim being 50%, being Maori. And
One of the good things, Rodney, is that some of the people pushing back most strongly against this nonsense are themselves Maori.
yes.
I mean, we look at the
Well,
cabinet.
you had the wonderful Casey Costello.
Casey Costello, who was a co-spokesperson for Hobson's Pledge for a number of years, basically since the inception, in fact, and she's now in cabinet. Winston Peters, of course, is clearly Maori. So is Shane Jones,
David Seymour.
David Seymour, Nicole McKee, Karen Chow. In fact, seven of the 20 ministers of cabinet are now Maori, but apparently that doesn't count.
Well, they're not the right Maori.
No, that's right. Not the right Maori. That's right.
I went along on another story to my local school board, and there was an iwi representative. I don't know how to say this, Don, without being rude to her and rude for your listeners, but I was sitting there thinking, my bottom cheeks are more brown than her. You would not have picked her as Maori. She was as white as white.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there extolling. And of course, it's inherently so racist. Because what it's saying is, because I have some Maori in my ancestry, I'm different. I think differently. I bring a different view, which is the very essence of being racist. It's not like you're a Martin Luther King individual choosing your way, developing your talents and skills and your character to be judged on that and not the color of your skin. We're reducing New Zealand to everything is skin color, and it can be pretty pale and be called Maori.
Well, yes, that, as you point out, it's not even skin color. Some so-called Maori are indistinguishable from people like you and me. So it's a bizarre and terribly dangerous situation, I think. And while I thought we were going to make major progress under this current government, and we are making some, let's be fair, it's not nearly the progress which I thought we would be making. Marine and Coastal Area Act is another one where the coalition agreement between National and New Zealand First was unambiguous. They wanted that act to be amended to reflect the original intention of Parliament back in 2011 when it was passed. And unfortunately, that hasn't yet happened.
Well, the people aren't getting what they voted for, and the coalition agreements aren't delivering.
In many respects, that's absolutely right.
Can I tell you a dark thought that I have on this?
I'm sorry,
Can I tell you my dark thought that I have on this?
please do. If you're happy to share it with your viewers.
Yes, it's dark and it could be completely wrong because it's just my thought. You and I both know Mr. Peters pretty well. And he's an extremely able campaigning politician. Not so good on being a minister and doing the work. And I think he set Mr. Luxon up extraordinarily well. Because Mr. Luxon's now starting to sink. And at some point leading up to the election, Mr. Peters can say, they're not delivering on our coalition agreement and pull the pin. And he would romp in.
Yes, I think. Well, would he make a majority in Parliament? He might, I
Oh,
suppose.
he may not make a majority, but man, how many votes would flow from national
That's true.
voters to Mr. Peters
Absolutely.
if he said, I've been trying to sort this woke nonsense out, I've been trying to sort this Maori nonsense out, I am a Maori. We're being held up by this white fellow, Mr. Luxon. And say it's over or it's no good or something. And he could go to 25, 30%.
Yeah, I don't see him going quite that high, but of course,
Okay.
David Seymour, we're doing the same thing. David Seymour, we're making the same point exactly. I promised you the option of having a bill before Parliament and a referendum to say
Yes.
we're all equal, and
Yes.
Mr. Luxon
No,
is
I
gone.
concur. And in fact, it'd be quite funny because, in many ways, they're not chasing the same votes in terms of demographic.
That's true.
And they both could do very well out of it. And National's in severe danger on this issue. So we've made some progress, but of course, it's been from a National-led government, it's been grudging and a bit haphazard rather than philosophical. This is what we believe in, and we're going to put a stop to it and make sure it never happens again.
Yes, my hunch is that the National Party caucus is quite deeply divided on this stuff.
Yes.
My best evidence for that, I think, was when Judith Collins was leader of the National Party. She was very good on this stuff after the Hei Pūapua report was revealed in 2021. She gave a couple of very strong speeches indeed at National Party conferences deploring this kind of separatism, and then she went silent. And I suspect that on that issue, she suddenly found she didn't have majority support in caucus. So I think the National Party caucus is divided on this issue. Some people agreeing very strongly with what ACT and New Zealand First are saying on this particular issue, but other members of the caucus who are younger and therefore almost by definition, given the history of our recent developments in New Zealand, more woke on this particular issue.
We're going down a path with co-governance that is a worldwide disaster.
Yeah, that's right.
Countries like Malaysia, Fiji, Sri Lanka, with ethnic tension, graft, and corruption. That's inevitable and ultimately violence.
I think that's right.
And you would never have believed it if someone had told you this 20 or 30 years ago that we could be in this place.
Yeah.
Can I tell you my great story?
Please do.
You will be familiar with Dr. Thomas Sowell.
Indeed.
So, for listeners, Dr. Thomas Sowell is a preeminent black economist who
American.
grew up a Marxist, poor in the Bronx. To avoid being conscripted, he enlisted in the Korean War, got put down for intelligence because they would have given him an IQ test. He was a high school dropout. And he came back from the Korean War and, under the GI Bill, went to university where he shone in economics. And I can't remember what university he was at, but they rang Milton Friedman and George Stigler and said, "You have to take this man because he's brilliant." And he went on to do a PhD under two Nobel Prize winners, Milton Friedman and George Stigler. He studied under Milton Friedman and George Stigler, who, of course, the Chicago School of Economics and totally free market. And he was still a Marxist. And having secured his PhD, he got a job in Washington, D.C., for the Bureau of Labor. And it cured him within 3 months. And he became a Chicago school economist by experience. And he has spent his entire career studying empirically and writing amazing books, in particular studying affirmative action. And he wrote a great book called Affirmative Action, A Worldwide Disaster. Very reclusive man. In 1989, he came to New Zealand to the Mount Pelerin Society, where I was invited along to speak. Not to speak, to attend. He was invited to speak. But he never socialized. He just went to his room and wrote. And I got into the lift. I'll never forget this. And of course, he's just a hero to you and me and everyone of the Silkway. He's so amazing. And he's in the lift. And of course, you sort of recognize him because there's not many Negro black men in Christchurch at a conference. And I said, "Oh, you're Tom Sowell." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Some students and I would like to take you for dinner." And he said, "I'd love that." And we took him for dinner at some Thai restaurant, something little obscure place, four, five of us, me and four of my students. And I ended up spending the entire weekend with him, showing him around the Port Hills because he liked taking pictures. But it's the greatest dinner of my life because he basically conversed over dinner his next book. All the facts and figures and insights. He was just the most wonderful conversationalist. And then it came what to do about New Zealand. Now recall this is 1989. And I explained to him about the treaty and here and the grievance. And they're trying to settle these grievances. And he said, "What do you think settling these grievances will cost?" And I said, well, there's talk of $1 billion. But that's an extraordinary amount of money. That was the fiscal, it became the fiscal envelope offer.
That's right.
He said, well, make it 10 billion or maybe 20. Make a number so big it shocks the entire country. Pay it and remove everything to do with the treaty and grievance in the statute book. Make it one law. I said, well, probably the government that handed out 10 or 20 billion would be voted out. He said, yes, but they'll be recalled as heroes. Because he said, if you don't do this, your country will descend into racial violence. And I came away thinking, there's Tom Sowell. He studied the whole world, but he doesn't understand New Zealand.
And you're
Because I
wrong.
couldn't imagine the nastiness that we now see. Great story.
It's a great story.
And would you go back there and do the 10 billion?
Like a flash.
In a heartbeat. In an absolute heartbeat, Don. The other thing you observe is those pushing co-governance, very angry, very nasty, and now with Te Pāti Māori openly advocating violence. What do you make of that?
It's a scary situation, I think. Very scary. It's not clear where it will end. But as you say, $10 billion would have been a bargain.
You can't, you could, I couldn't see it. I literally couldn't see it. Tell me what you make of immigration and its effect on New Zealand and its effect on this debate. Because down here in Queenstown, like you go into the supermarket and every worker is a recent immigrant, or maybe not so recent. But that's got to A, change New Zealand, and B, maybe have an effect on this debate, surely. Have you had thoughts on that? Like, how does a, putting aside whether it's a good idea to have workers coming in and establishing families and we become Indian and Chinese, but I come into New Zealand, I'm working away, and I'm second rate because of co-governance. What have they done wrong?
Yeah, well, that's right. They didn't come here to be second-class citizens, and that's effectively what they've become. Because again, they have no Maori ancestry, and that, by definition, in this co-governance world, makes them second-class citizens, and that's absolutely appalling. And that should not be the case. And the risk we run, of course, is that those frequently very productive citizens will hightail and leave, as indeed many citizens of New Zealand, of European ethnicity, are doing also, of course. That's not good news.
You can understand why parents are telling their kids to leave.
You have a son offshore. I have a son
Yes.
offshore.
Yes.
They may never come back.
Funnily enough, my son is in finance, as you know, in New York. And he said for like 3 or 4 years, they hadn't taken on an intern because to do so they had to go through the human resource outfit and apply the diversity, equity, and inclusive thing.
Yeah.
And there'd be no white heterosexual male employed for years.
Yep.
And of course, I'm noticing it with my daughter who's 13. Her friends that are boys, because she goes along to air cadets, one of them wants to go into the Air Force, and there's no scholarship for him or support for him because he's neither Maori nor woman. And he's 14, and
Yeah.
he states that out loud.
Yeah.
And we are in a bleak place for him. Tell us the good news, Don.
The good news is that there is still a very strong measure of support for treating all New Zealanders as equal. The polling done on the Treaty Principles Bill, for example, showed that a majority of national voters, ACT voters, and New Zealand First voters, and even a substantial number of Labour voters, all supported what that bill was saying.
Wow.
So, New Zealanders want a country where everyone is treated equally. And that includes many Maori New Zealanders are saying that. We want to be treated equally. You mentioned Casey Costello earlier and the other members of the cabinet who are
And
Maori.
the bill itself is to call for a referendum.
That's right. Mind you, a
So,
referendum on three very clearly indicated principles. And
yes.
that's pretty unobjectionable for the most part. I mean, you
So
can't.
it's not like you're rushing through and jamming the legislation upon New Zealand.
No.
So my only, you don't need to comment because you're more polite than me. But my only conclusion is that Christopher Luxon is a coward because the politics supports him in supporting that bill through
Parliament.
Through Parliament. His principles of his party support him.
Yep.
Voters support him. It's very democratic because it's open to a referendum.
Yep.
But the activists scare him.
I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's the activists scaring him or whether he actually doesn't believe in equal citizenship. I mean, Hobson's
Whoa.
Pledge ran a social media campaign at one point, attacking the fact that he would not support the bill. We referred to him as a scaredy cat. Now, I must say, I didn't much like that expression, talking about the Prime Minister, but I'm told that was what we were right in saying, and I was happy, therefore, to endorse it. But you have to wonder what on earth prompts him to be so timid on this issue. As you say, the politics support him.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to head in. You're going to be very busy in the run up to the next election, Don. It's so good to see you looking so extraordinarily well. How do people get a hold of you and your organisation? It's a web page. What's the web page?
Hobsonspledge.nz, no apostrophe,
And
Hobsonspledge.nz.
it's crucial. It's crucial at this time, heading into this next election, that we become an overwhelming force for our
Absolutely.
politicians because our country depends upon it. Don, on behalf of all our listeners, we salute you. Are you able to tell us how old you are?
Happy to.
Are you able to tell us how old you are?
yes, I think I can count that high. 84.
Isn't that something? There's Don, aged 84, grassroots, built an organisation and holding governments to account here in New Zealand. I salute you, Don, and you're an inspiration to us all because we often feel as though, oh, well, you know, a bit busy, but you're 84, you can do it. Oh, my goodness. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. What a pleasure it is to have Don Brash on. How lucky are we to have him in our midst? How lucky are we to have him with the courage to stand up and speak up? And if more of us did so, we would win. So we need to learn from his example. Join him, support him, to support your country. Send us a text at 2057. Email me inbox at rallycheck.radio. Thank you so much for listening.